Great. So what I'm going to talk about is kind of an approach to an analysis of the first year of real running of the LHC, where we're going to have data at 14 TeV and seeing what can we do with the very first data that we get, where we won't understand detector stuff very well. You know, we won't understand missing ET very well. But you know, we're going to want to be able to get to discriminate between large classes of models already in that first bit of data, so that you know, once we've narrowed down theory space, we can we can narrow down theory space as much as possible in that first bit of running, just be as efficient as possible in getting to you know, the answer of what is it that we're seeing. This talk is going to be more about methods and routines rather than actual results. It's a Blackboard talk. I can't show too many plots or anything like that. So I'm really just going to discuss, you know, what are the tools that we've developed for this analysis, and what is the overall sort of philosophy. So. This is work that I've been doing with Joseph Licken, Rizzio Perini, and Maria Spiropoulou. I'm the only pure theorist, I guess, since Joseph Licken is now an official member of CMS, if you haven't heard. So generically, we have some infinite theory space. And what we want to do is do the LHC inverse problem. We want to map data back onto this theory space. We want to find out, you know, if I have some data at the LHC, where does this map back to in this really sort of uncountable infinity of different scenarios? Of course. Experimentally, this infinite dimensional theory space, this infinite theory space, really gets mapped onto sort of a countable infinity of models that are indistinguishable, you know, just small variations of parameters. You know, two MSSM scenarios with, you know, slightly different input parameters, things like this. And then, once you take into account actual data, this gets mapped onto basically a large N set of distinguishable models at the LHC. So how does 20 questions play into this? So 20 questions is a game. And what you have is some, you know, secret answer that somebody has, and then what you try to do is you ask some number of questions that, you know, and each answer that you get for the questions that you ask, you build off of and you base your next question on the answer to that. So that's really the approach that we're going to be taking in performing this mapping backwards. So what this does is get you to an answer in log n steps, which is important when you have large n rather than, you know, order n or than order n. So what you would do is you basically eliminate approximately 50% of the candidates. Well, the hope is that if you design your questions in the correct way, that you eliminate roughly 50% of the scenarios per question that you ask. But it's important that you ask smart questions. So as I've said, the first 100 inverse picobarns. What we want to do is come up with a list of smart questions that we can ask with this first little bit of data. And what is the way to come up with these smart questions? Well, it's just sort of, you know, fool around. Come up with a few different theories here that are in principle distinguishable. Send them through a sort of Monte Carlo tools analysis detector simulation. Another thing is we want to make this as realistic as possible because we want to be doing kind of a dry run of what this first year of running at the LHC is going to be like. And so in order to ask smart questions, you need realistic simulation. At least you want to get as close as to what things are actually going to be like at the detectors and in the environment of the LHC. So in order to actually approach this, you need to make some assumptions about your analysis. So what we took, at least in this first approach, is we made the assumption that there's going to be some missing ET signature, and jets at the LHC. Now, this is, everybody sort of knows the generic reason why we should be doing this, but just to sort of restate it, we have evidence for dark matter. It's experimentally, it hasn't been directly found, but that it must exist in some form. We have a theoretical prior that physics is natural, that the hierarchy problem should be solved. And sort of a corollary to this is that there should be some new physics that comes in that's strongly coupled to QCD. And now, sort of putting this together, what we've sort of found through the years is that in order to get this, in order to solve this problem and preserve the global symmetries that are very important in the standard model, things like custodial SU2, baryon number. Generically, it seems that a discrete symmetry is a good possibility. And so there's a good chance that this dark matter is weakly coupled. And this is further motivated by the sort of coincidence that when you evaluate what the relative abundance of this dark matter is based on WMAP and other different astrophysical observables, you weakly coupled dark matter turns out to give you roughly the right order of magnitude for the relic abundance. So all of this put together makes a pretty compelling case for LHC pair production of strongly coupled exotica. Which will then decay to some number of jets plus something, plus other stuff, leptons, whatever, and then one particle that contributes to missing ET, and then the same thing on the other side of this chain. And generically, you'll get cross sections that vary between 0.1 to 100 picobarns. So, and this is fairly simple and inclusive. We're just looking at ET plus jets plus something else. So what are the sort of issues with trying to do an analysis for missing ET plus jets plus X at the LHC in the first 100 inverse picobarns? The main thing is that missing ET is hard. So The main issues with Missing E.T. are that it's plagued with instrumental and other spurious backgrounds, things like cosmic rays scattering off a beam halo, and one of the important ones is jet mismeasurement. And in addition, there's the irreducible So things like semi-laconic TT bar, Dye boson, W and Z plus jets. Now, a lot of these events have a lepton, end up having a lepton in them. So you can find a way to get rid of a lot of these by having vetoing an event that have a lepton. But there's going to be still a few truly irreducible backgrounds, things like where you have Z to nu nu bar, where I won't have a lepton in the event.
Sorry, Jay, I thought in X1 you said leptons can be inferred.
That's right. Yeah. So you want to be careful about what kind of veto that you put on in this first hundred inverse picobar era. So I'll mention it briefly later, but there's this thing called an indirect lepton veto. And I probably don't need to go into too much detail about that, but it's not, you don't take events where you have a fully reconstructed lepton and throw those out. What you do is you throw out events where the hardest track is isolated, or where there's sort of too much electromagnetic stuff sitting around in one of your two hardest jets, and then you can toss those out, and you don't lose that much signal efficiency. Okay, so a lot of work has been done on this sort of problem. So you can open up your CMS Physics Technical Design Report. And they've done an analysis on some minimal Sugra points, low mass Susie points. And they have a set of a trigger, they have an ATMIS trigger. I'll explain in more detail about exactly what the trigger is in a little bit. And then a set of analysis cuts. And what they find is for different low mass SUSY points, different MSUGRA scenarios, you can get up to 25% efficiency for the SUSY signal, while getting a very dramatic reduction in the background. I'll talk a little bit more about exactly what cuts are used in a little bit. So what does this mean for the first 100 inverse picobarns? So after simulating backgrounds, which the CMS group did for this study, for a SUSY cross section of around total SUSY cross section of around 5 picobarns, you can have greater than 5 sigma discovery in the first 100 inverse picobarns in this ETMIS analysis.
So this analysis was designed for early running, so they tried to take into account that they wouldn't know their detectors while jet mismeasurement.
Exactly. Yeah, and that'll become more obvious when I show you exactly what the cuts are. They're very stringent, but mean, the important thing is that, you know, the signal is still rather efficient even after putting on these very stringent cuts requiring, you know, very energetic events. And also they don't do anything complicated with the jets. They just take the what you would call a rod jet, where they don't try to correct back to what the parton level is, or they just grab whatever got dumped in the calorimeter and just reconstruct their jets based on that. They don't do ET corrections for the jets.
If I understood you, Jay, your analysis cuts veto on leptons. Is that what you said?
Yeah, well, there's this indirect lepton veto.
So I mean, some plates have, you know, nice lepton signals in it. So, for example, for SPS1A, you're taking only the cross section that would avoid this lepton.
That's right. I mean, so you know, different points are going to have. I mean, your different channels are going to have different efficiencies. I suppose you'll be throwing away some information no matter what. But I mean, those are the things that, you know, you kind of have to do, I think, in this first 100 inverse picobarns of running in order to effectively get rid of the backgrounds enough that you can. You know, have an actual discovery in the missing ET channel.
Yeah, right.
It depends on
whether for SPS1A, for example, the efficiency really is 25%. Is there enough branching ratio directly into chi10 versus into chi20?
I mean, I don't know the details about SPS1A. That wasn't one of the models that through our analysis. But I don't remember exactly what was in the CMS PTDR. I don't know if they maybe you've look through it if they actually did SPS1A, but yeah. There's, that's right.
Hell, something or other is.
I thought there was some close, and now, you know.
Well, for LM1.
LM1, yeah.
SPS.
Okay, yeah, we did LM1.
But LM1 is largely lepton.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if the efficiency was 25% for it.
LM1, the efficiency was, I believe, 7%. Seven to 10%. Yeah. I mean, this is, of course, depends on what model you're looking at. I'm not claiming that generically you have. So let's just can get up to 25%, depending on what you're looking at.
So you're thinking about maybe the sparks and the gluminos, which are colored particles and decay-less and into jets.
Yes.
The only question I would then have is, since they tend to be very massive, are you going to get enough cross-section in the first year?
Well, that's what we've worked on. So, I mean, can you get this five sigma discovery in the first year? And so we stick to models where that is the case. And that I should mention that this is even the case if you. So the question is, how well did these guys actually model the standard model backgrounds? I mean, the real question is, are the tools advanced enough to be modeling the backgrounds well enough on, you know, the far, far tails of the standard model background to believe this? And so if you take the standard model background and, for example, triple it, this still holds true for, you know, a reasonable set of model space. The question is, a factor of three is even, if that's conservative or not conservative. It's possible to get, you know, factors of 10 if you're not careful when you're way out on the tails. But
Jay.
But let's assume that they did a good enough job of this.
So you know that the relevant rule of thumb between the parent particle and the dark matter particle is the mass difference. When the mass difference is very small, in general, the general rule of thumb is that your backgrounds totally obscure your dark matter signature, and you can't see it. For example, ZET mu nu is a huge background in general for.
Yeah, I'm not claiming that all models are going to be discovered in the first 100 inverse picobarns, but we're going to assume that there is a number of models that could be discovered at 5 sigma in the first 100 inverse picobarns. And now, what can we do to distinguish these? I mean, maybe we won't see anything, and that's going to be part of our 20 questions game. That's going to eliminate a large set of our model space if nothing shows up in this first bit. But then the question is, if we do see something, how can we, you know, how can we sort of narrow ourselves down so that we know, you know, the next question to ask. I mean, seeing nothing also tells you what questions you should ask next. Ask next. Okay. Boy, I have 7 pages. we don't need to cover everything. So this is what CMS has done, and also there's, I'll mention the LHC inverse problem paper.
Sorry, can I ask just one thing? So we're going lepton. So leptons are probably most understood in the beginning, right? I mean, it's the easiest context to deal with in the beginning. So
muons, CMS. We've been working in CMS because the CMS heavy bit of my collaboration here. But
so again, you probably said this, but why veto leptons in the beginning?
So again, we're not vetoing leptons directly. It's an indirect lepton veto. So we're not. There's a lot of events that are going to have muons in them, where, you know, so if you identify this track as a muon, you don't throw away that event. You're just throwing away events where you have single isolated tracks that are very, very hard, and jets that have too much electromagnetic stuff in them. So, I mean, this reduces the leptonic part of the standard model background by roughly a factor of 2. If you did a direct lepton veto, that would reduce it a lot more, but you know, you'd be throwing away too much of the interesting part of your signal. Okay, so there's the LHC. So what they did is a chi-squared analysis. Of something like 1,808 different observables. One thing to note is that these are almost certainly correlated. And this chi-squared analysis was performed without taking into account these correlations. So that's something that would need to be done in addition to this, with different M supra points. And what they pointed out is that degeneracies exist in this mapping. Even after 10 inverse femtobarns of running, where you have a good, better handle on what missing ET is, on how to reconstruct corrected jets rather than these raw jets that I was discussing before.
Jake, is each bin an observable?
Is each in this?
Yeah, in that counting.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah,
is considered one observable.
I mean, I wasn't. Part of this analysis, so I don't know all the details, but you were, yeah.
So you're already thinking that there's an excess amount of standard one.
Yes. So this sort of analysis is probably not the right thing to do in the first 100 inverse picobarns, and so I just need to mention it as, you know, part of what's been done to move towards moving this direction to get this mapping. Okay, so as I've been saying, the moment of discovery, getting this 5 sigma is going to be much different if you happen to be, you know, these models happen to be, nature happens to be kind to us. We're going to have small samples. And also, importantly, a limited object palette. So what I mean by a limited object palette is tau's these sorts of things are kind of off limits at this stage. Also, this stage, things like peaks and edges are probably not going to be visible. And as I said, the observables that you're going to be able to come up with that do potentially discriminate are going to be strongly correlated to one another by systematics. And these correlations are going to be poorly understood in the beginning. So what can we get away with? So we can probably be able to tell, if nature is relatively kind, that missing ET comes from exotics, not neutrinos. That the ET, missing ET, is from two particles, not 1, 3, 3,000. This is probably not even missing ET at that stage. And then that there's at least, and whether there's one or more than one, kinematically accessible parent particles in a decay chain. So to be able to distinguish probably between these separate cases.
Jay, half an hour ago I would have had the two columns separate, interchanged.
Which two columns?
You're teaching me something here. The peaks, I thought peaks was sort of easy, but you didn't know where the peaks were, but you would see peaks.
Oh, do you mean in resonances or? Okay. Yeah, I'm thinking more in terms of a missing ET signal where you have, you know, bumps and.
So bump and what though? What peak can you not do?
Well, he's refusing to look at isolated leptons, so he would never see the C prime.
No, but
that's one thing he won't see,
right? But if there's, I mean,
you mean like an edge?
The definition of a peak is a peak.
he's working in a framework where there are no resonances, right? He's working in a framework where there are no singly produced resonances, so he's not. I don't think you really mean it.
So I think, I probably mean these two sort of together. When I have an edge, I sort of have, you know, something like this, right? So really what I want to stay away from are things like distributions, because I'm not going to understand my binning very well, and you know, this whole thing could be very distorted, and I shouldn't really trust.
So
I mean you can find them, I guess, but.
Are you imagining it's JJ in my mass or so on?
The thing is, how many events do I have? I mean, I might have typically, you know, 300 events or something like that. And so, it's a question of, do I have even enough statistics to build up a distribution where I can see something like this?
I see. These columns are not a statement of the capabilities of the detector.
No.
They're a statement of the assumption of all the various models that come in and then what you can do with them.
No. That's right. I mean, maybe you will be able to do this if you have some model that's going to, you know, have a high efficiency to pass your cuts. But.
I see. And the same goes for bees. It's you won't see bees just because there's not enough of them separated from background, not because the silicon isn't installed yet or something.
Right. Okay. Yeah, the silicon's there.
So just 300 events, I'd be really surprised about your second plane here in terms of size. There are two missing ET. Versus say one missing ET.
Well, it depends on what other observables you can cook up to try to distinguish between. I mean, you won't be able to see this just by how many events pass your main analysis, but then you can come up with numerous other observables, ratios of, you know, 4 jets to 3 jets, things like this.
But you're thinking about the framework that there's no clear, like, isolated lepton or something. I just make sure the framework. And then you don't have any clear peak, or just the resonances on that, those
right. Models.
Like, say, typical ends of the point, or something.
Yeah, so what we're throwing at the analysis are different MSSM models, not tied to SUGRA. And then as a little fun test, a little Higgs model with T parity.
So, and then this statement that the peaks and edges are not usable is for, say, a jet combined mass distribution or something like that.
That's right. Or, I mean, you can, if you have, you know, multi-leptons, you could try to do something like this, but you probably won't have, you know, enough events with, you know, 2 leptons in order to be able to, in order to put this together. But with just this missing ET plus jets analysis chain.
So I also wonder
if
one of the issues is getting a false peak where there isn't one. So is that what makes you say that you shouldn't look at peaks because of jet energy mismeasurement and so on?
I mean, I think it's just a matter of statistics. Do I have enough events to put something like this together in the first 100 inverse Pico Barnes? I'm not saying that this is completely off limits, but in most of the scenarios that we're looking at, you just don't have enough statistics to build up something like this, because we have such hard cuts on missing ET. I mean, that's what we have to do when we don't understand missing ET very well. You have to have a very hard cut on it before you.
How hard is the cut?
Yeah, okay, so let me just talk about what the analysis is, since I'm doing good. Let me just finish up this. So you can see whether there are leptons. Now again, this is because I haven't thrown away events with reconstructed leptons. I've used this indirect lepton veto, so there are still events with leptons in decay chains that are going to get through the analysis path. And you can be able to tell that these leptons came from some exotics in the decay chain, rather than from W's and Z's, because the standard model background gets cut so severely by this analysis path. So what is the analysis path? So what we did is just built on the CMS PTDR study and used basically the same analysis path that they used, so that we could use their background analysis without having to do our own simulations of background, which we trust far, far less, because we don't have, you know, full detector simulation and things like this to throw the standard model backgrounds at. And so we'd be easily off by make even a couple orders of magnitude in efficiencies if we tried to simulate the standard model backgrounds ourselves, and we wouldn't really trust it.
So Jay, often people, I mean, experimenters often say that to build an analysis on missing ET will take them several years to understand all the features of the detectors. Are you somehow assuming ideal detectors here,
So we're not assuming ideal detectors, but we're going to such extremes in cuts on missing ET that you won't understand your detectors that poorly in the beginning. I don't think if you have a cut of 220 GeV on missing ET, I would think that that's something that's something real at that stage. I mean, and I think at some level, I'm kind of trusting that what they did in the PTDR is reasonable when they studied the first 100 inverse pico barns with, you know, with their study. And so I don't think I can, I'm not qualified enough to give a lecture on why missing ET is hard, but what it seems to be is that if you put a hard enough cut on it, then you can have, you have some reliability on, the fact that you are seeing something new and not just, not understanding your detector.
But somehow that's the assumption here, that if you have any kind of missing ET signal, you know that it's real.
Extremely well at 10 inverse filter barns, jets picking lap times. I mean, all these things that you have to worry about. What you're really looking at is excesses, not peaks, excesses. And that's the hardest thing. Right. History is littered with examples of, UA1, where people look at these excesses and they look like 5-7 sigma, but later on they turn out to be 2s, things like that. And that's what I'm just worried about.
I have a more detailed concern here. I mean, was this CMS PTDR done before or after these, the radiated corrections and what have you were revisited and they, and the shapes of the standard model background started to look very similar to the signals, and in fact, doing missing ET alone. No matter where you cut, you could never get rid of the background for many models. Was this done before or after that?
I actually don't know the answer to that question.
The TDR only came out a year ago, so it's much more up to date than the Atlas TDR.
It's a question of when the analysis was done, though, relative to the release of the
shapes. I mean, what happened, of course, is after the detailed consideration of the background, the signal did not stick out as a extra excess, different shape above the standard model background anymore in the ET spectrum. And I don't know what
Are you talking about this matrix element improvement?
That's right. Yeah. So it was a bunch of
2 or 3 years ago, right?
So is this the new TDR or the old TDR?
This is the new TDR.
Do you think it's the new one?
I don't know when the analysis was done relative to the release of the TDR. If they updated this analysis.
So that's what. So I'm questioning then.
It's a reasonable question. You can open it up and look. Okay, so what requires that missing ET is greater than 200 GeV, that there are greater than or equal to 3 jets with PT. PT greater than 30 GeV, and then there are further cuts on jets later on, that the eta for these jets is less than 3, that the eta for the leading jet is less than 1.7, which means it's in the main central tracker fiducial volume. So the ET is not corrected in the presence of muons. So mu's don't necessarily deposit all their energy, and so there can be you can get confused about what the missing ET is based on how much energy the muon actually deposits. So that's why.
Can I just ask a question here? So, an ET missing of 200 GeV, I mean, I've heard people talk about jet energy resolutions on the order of 10% or even 20% in early LHC running. So even 200 GeV is a lot, but you get a lot of TEV jets. So
Well, that's part of the question I'm asking is that, you know, my memory is that this wouldn't do it.
I mean, it seems like a pretty detailed question to me. I mean, if they, like I said, they talk about 10-20% jet resolution in early running, so, you know.
Well, the lines you're going to write down is that Delta flies, right?
Excuse me?
There are also Delta flies that I assume you're about to write down, right? No?
Well, there's, yeah, Delta R's, Delta R's for the jets. Yeah, yeah,
so
that's right.
That, the demanding some angular separation cuts back significantly, right? That's measuring one jet.
So that 20% is, I see. So if you widen your cones, you get a better, you can do better.
Well, it's just to be clear, you're missing energy in the line beneath the jets.
That's right. So that cuts down on, yeah, there's QCD angular cuts are somewhere in here. Yeah, I'm not going to give a detailed list of exactly what everything is, but there's QCD angular cuts that we were just discussing. I've already talked a lot about this indirect lepton veto scheme. So then to reduce mainly the standard model backgrounds, we require that the leading jet has PT greater than 180 GeV, and that the subleading has PT greater than 110 GeV. I didn't write down the number here. I think I know what it is.
Subleading means the next leading.
So yeah, that's right. Yeah, the first sub, well, next subleading jet. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I thought. And then HT which is defined as the ET of the ith jet, so summing from most from subleading to second subleading on, plus ET is greater than 500 GeV.
So the hardest jet is not included.
That's right. Yeah. So very very energetic events. And so now. So this is the analysis path, and you can pass different trigger samples through this analysis path. So what are the trigger samples that are going to be around? We have an ET miss trigger, where you just collect events. So all of these triggers have kind of a turn on as a function of the cut. So let's say ET around 109 GeV. So you have a turn on for this trigger, where the trigger is 50% efficient at 110 GeV. So you can imagine so you draw a plot of ET and the efficiency for this trigger, then you get a slope like, you get something like this. And the 50% line is right around 109 GeV. And then, so then there's further triggers that also have different turn-ons. There's a die-jet trigger. There's a tri-jet trigger. And there's a muon 20 trigger. So muon 20, so muon 20 is, so if there's an energetic muon in the event that's not necessarily isolated, this trigger is 88% efficient for a 20 GeV muon. And it asymptotes to 95% fairly quickly by around 30 GeV.
Sorry, this the shape that you've drawn, is that designed, or is it what you get when you apply this trigger?
Just the way that the trigger is designed, you know, the hardware response. There's some efficiency for this trigger as a function of the amount of missing ET in the event. And so if there's a small amount of missing ET, it might turn on down here. Your trigger might, you know, dump the event in your sample down here, but you know, it's not so likely. But once you have enough missing ET, it's very likely. And this trigger is fairly rapid, but it's, you know, you should model this if you can to get something as realistic as possible.
That is what I was trying to ask you. Is there 50 GeV of missing ET? Is the statement that you don't want to keep it, or you cannot keep it?
Well, there's some small probability that you're going to keep that event.
Yes, but is that designed that way, or even if I wanted to keep more of it, I cannot?
I don't think it's designed that way. I just think it's, you know, a function of the hardware that you have available to you.
If you wanted 15B, you'd have to go to the trigger monster, buy him a beer, and then make it lower. And then they would overwhelm the electronics, and then they would switch it back.
Right. So you have four samples. So you have four samples that you can pass through this analysis path. And before passing it through the analysis path, what this looks like, you have the missing ET trigger sample, and then you have an overlapping diejet sample. And then there's trijet. These should all. And then here's the muon 20. So this is before passing everything through the analysis. So you have a bunch of samples, and they're going to have some overlap with one another. So now, the question is, what happens to this sort of picture once you pass it through this analysis path? What you end up getting is that all of the other trigger samples besides missing ET are just subsets of the missing ET sample. So. And so now this points at, you know, some different things that you can play with once you have this analysis path. You can see I have some number of events that pass my overall that pass the analysis that came from the missing ET sample. And now I can just figure out what subset of those events also were in the diejet sample versus how many were in the trijet sample and muon 20. And so this is a sort of a zeroth order way to distinguish between some of the different models that you put through the analysis path. What are the ratios of events that you get in each of these samples? So this sort of simplifies things. You only need to have one complete analysis based on this analysis path, and then everything else is just binning that main analysis into these different categories.
So you don't have the two-jet thing, right? Because you already said it's bigger than three-jet. Three or more jets.
It's inclusive, so.
So it doesn't include just two jets.
Let's see. So, I mean, I didn't write down all the details of exactly what the diejet trigger is. There's some, you know, let's see, I can write it down, and then you can.
No, I'm just trying to understand the statement greater than or equal to T-jets.
This is trigger analysis.
Right.
This is part of the diejet.
That's right, but it depends on what the actual trigger is compared to the cuts that we send through here.
I'm sorry, I know you answered this question about three times, but I'm still confused. What muons are you keeping, and what muons are you throwing away? Can you just roughly say that again? You said, I just didn't understand what you were doing.
So it depends on the tools that you have at your disposal, I guess.
Well, just your analysis, you're keeping some muons and throwing some away, right?
So that's what's going to happen eventually if you do.
Right now, this is just their trigger, their muon trigger, their energetic muon trigger.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's going to be, you know, sometimes that, you know, a muon just looks like, you know, an isolated track, and it doesn't get reconstructed as a muon, and so those will get vetoed, I believe.
So you say that you're going to veto isolated muons.
You veto isolated tracks.
Okay.
It's that hasn't been reconstructed as an actual muon. Okay.
So with this trigger, how many of these muons are real muons, and how many of them are QCD stuff that punches through or something like that?
Yeah, so then you get into the details of what are the tools that you have at your disposal. What we have in our case is just a fast detector simulation, and so we can't really answer detailed questions like that. In fact, I haven't gotten to it yet. I mean, this is part of what CMS-TDR did. In our analysis with the tools we have at our disposal, we had to sort of let go of a couple of the requirements here, because things that didn't have very much effect on signal efficiencies in this analysis path can be devastating to the signal efficiencies when you only have a very sort of low level simulation. What we use is this retooled version of PGS that won't get a chance to talk about too much.
Muon is both in track and also muon at the muon chamber, right?
That's right.
So
there's no punch.
Pretty much muon. Yeah, pretty much muon.
It's just kind of muon, right?
That's right.
Or a conflict, right?
Right.
Things can punch through.
I don't think so. I was at the beginning of the workshop, I was shouted down when I asked the punch through question. Maybe it was John that was shouted.
Maybe it was you. No, I think if you're at high enough ET, it can happen. Maybe not from normal standard model QCD, but under physics.
So do you remember how high the digit, the PT is?
Yeah, I can. I have it written down. I just didn't want to spend. Let's see. So digit is two very hard jets. And what I mean by very hard is ET greater than 337 GeV. Which explains this. And then for a tri-jet, it's three hard jets. This is where it's 50% efficient, by the way.
That's some of the ETs? Or?
No, two very hard jets, each with ET greater than 337 GeV. And here we have three hard jets, and the trigger is 50%. Efficient for ET greater than 180 GeV. Okay. So I'm just going to talk a little bit. I'm not going to have a chance to talk about it very much at all, but just the sort of tools that we've been developing for this. The idea is that you want to be able to take some BSM physics model and generate some events with it, and then, you know, simulate showering, hadronization, and all of these things. So you need to somehow put this model through an entire analysis chain. So we have sort of two things that you can do here. What we use is MadGraph, MadEvent for some part of our model sampling. So you just take, this just takes parton level, so this generates parton level events. So 2-to-2 scattering, for example. And then you can feed this into Pythia. For showering. And hadronization. Now, of course, there's a little bit of crosstalk between these two when you are talking about things like matching, do you simulate extra jets at the matrix element level, or do you treat it with the parton shower? And so, really to be more realistic with this, you need to have a more full scheme here. And with MadGraph and MadEvent, we interface with Bridge. And one of the authors, Matt, is here. So what you can do with Bridge is simulate on-shell multi-stage decays. And this just factorizes the phase space, so I don't need to do two to n and do the entire integration over phase space. I can just take the narrow width approximation and plug this through. And this keeps spin correlations, by the way, not that it's incredibly important for this particular study. And then you want to send this to some sort of detector simulation. Now, for our purposes, we need something fast. Ideally, we'd pump this through the full detector simulation. But this takes on order 1 minute per event for, say, a 2 gigahertz CPU. So that's unacceptable for what we want to be doing, scanning over many different models, sending many different models through this chain. And so what we developed to have something pseudo-realistic is a version of PGS that's been designed for the CMS detector. And PGS CMS has been tuned using results from the full detector simulation that were used in the CMS PTDR analysis. So you can take the LM1 study, look at the cut-by-cut efficiencies, and tool around with the parameters of PGS, and then also add some other additional sort of baggage to PGS that makes PGS jets look more like the uncorrected jets that CMS PTDR were studying. And then we also designed a suite of analysis tools that, for example, accomplish this analysis for us, do this binning, and then you can compute other observables within this framework that I haven't had a chance to get to. This is built off of something called XRoot analysis, built off of Root, which is the gold standard for experimentalists. So what you can do is just build histograms and make nice plots. It's a really nice way to sort of take the data that comes out of here and arrange it very quickly into different routines, different analyses, different observables. And also since the authors are in the audience, I don't know exactly how this could feed into this chain, but maybe Marmoset, this on-shell effective theory approach can plug in in some way in this chain, and that might be another way to approach this problem. But we haven't done it from that perspective. We've just taken different models that have been implemented in MadGraph, MadEvent, or they're implemented in Pithy already, things like the MSSM.
So, Jay, what do we do with the Salama background for jet events or something? We just assume that we start.
Yeah. So after this analysis path, there's a 245 standard model background events.
So how do you deal with the Salama model background? What did you do with the Salama model jet?
So there's only 25 events here, and so we can more or less ignore them for a large part of our routine here.
Yeah.
So if you only have 25 events, then it's not. And we have say 500 events from signal, then this number is around just so we can make sure that we actually had five sigma discovery. Really, realistically, we want to have you know, the full sample that CMS used, but we don't have that available to us at this time. So, I mean, you know, further work should be done to model the backgrounds and then send them to this chain. I mean, ideally everything goes through full detector simulation, but you know, you need to do some scanning with a fast simulation tool. Find a bunch of models that. You know, look the same after going through this analysis path, have the same number of events, and then once you have a number of lookalike models, now you can put those through the full detector simulation. So you need to have something to be able to do the scanning first before you really go whole hog and go through the full detector simulation and spend, you know, a lot more time.
So after your EGS simulation, mm-hmm. you're coming out with some objects that you choose to keep.
That's right.
Like jets with a certain ET.
Yes.
Missing ET or something. So
and that's not the analysis level.
So you have a certain number of variables that you're going to live with at the end of all of this EGS, right?
Yes.
And those are the variables you're going to compute distributions from. Is that the idea?
We stay away from distribution, but those are the variables that get binned into you know, different subsets of this main analysis. You know, the number of events, say with missing ET greater than 320 GeV, something like that. So,
okay,
so you can you know, further subdivide this into a whole bunch of different classes. And once you do that, then you can discriminate between other models between a host of different models that produce the same number of events in this overall sample. So we have what we call lookalike models, where n is the same. So what you just want to do is come up with a bunch of these lookalike models, and then the idea is to try to come up with different observables that, you know, will. You know, that will be different for these different lookalikes. So it's just, you know, sort of just, you know, playing a little game and, you know, seeing what observables can I come up with that even with a small data sample where you have statistically significant differences between these different lookalikes. And I'm pretty much out of time here, so I'll just.
Are you 20 questions? Out on the blackboard already?
No, the 20 questions is really just that's the name of a game, right? And so that was just sort of an analogy for the work. So what we're really trying to do here is come up with the first few of the 20 questions. You know, what we want to do is we want to play this game, find the observables that do distinguish between different models. And then, so those observables are the first few questions, and we just want to be smart about the observables that we pick, so that we, you know, do tell the difference between these scenarios.
But you are still going to give us successful.
I mean, I have a huge list. I don't think you should read the paper. There's like, you know, 20 different things that we played with. It's a sort of a long-term project, but. But it's not appropriate for the blackboard.
I only wanted the first three. So.
Well, the first three are this, this, and this.
Okay.
And those—I mean—that's basically what's been handed to us by the experimentalists.
How are you going to run this countable infinity of models through this chain by 2009?
Well, it's not the idea isn't to run this countable infinity through. It's to, you know, come up with models that you know. So you're given some data sample, and you want to. I mean, it's clear that, you know, this countable infinity, most of them aren't going to give us any signal whatsoever in the first 100 inverse picobar, and so that, you know, narrows us down a lot already, at least to the models that we know about and can play with.
Can I just try to? That's the basic question. So you sort of assume the answer to maybe the first one or two questions, which is that
yes,
a large
that's right.
ET, there's a large cross section.
That's right.
Now you want to try to find what's the next question.
Yes.
So you have, what is the next question?
I mean, I think.
Do you have a suggestion for that?
I think the first thing that you can do, and that is obvious to do, is just take what the experimentalists give you, these trigger samples, and find out how does your main analysis sample break up under those three bins.
What's the number in those?
And then you can come up with some other observables like hemispheres, where you just sort of count, you define. You break up your event into sort of two halves, and the idea is hopefully that you have some event topology that if you have a symmetric event topology, then you can say, okay, well maybe I had some sort of a symmetric decay chain. Whereas if I had something asymmetric in hemispheres, then maybe my model had something that was just different on this side. I had something that only produced one jet on this side or three jets on that side, so for example. And that's just one of the things you can do. And then you can take other things that aren't quite as clear, but you can take the number of events in each of these samples with three jets divided by with four jets divided by the number with three jets that are in this analysis path. I mean there's a huge number of things that you can write down. 1,808 or something like that.
But I thought your point was to try and figure out which was the best question, so right. I wondered if you answered that question.
The results are sitting in my mailbox right now, and I haven't had a chance to open them. I mean, we're just finishing up this, wrapping up this project now. I mean, it really is kind of a long-term work in progress, and this is sort of the first stage in approaching this problem.
I thought that the
20-question
game is really associated with the theory.
Yeah,
I'm also confused. Because there's only a finite number of observables you can create, 1,800 or 2,000 or something, and you might as well just do them all, right? You have a big list and you just do them all. And the 20-question game is, out of this infinite number of different theory things, how do I make my way through it? I look at this observables and these observables and I make my way through it. And I thought that what you were demonstrating is that you don't need to do an infinite number of theories running through Pythia, that you should wait. Don't waste your time doing all 100 million permutations. Wait, here's a pathway that you're demonstrating of how to go from point to point through this finite number of observables to a specific location in the infinite space of theory possibility.
So I mean, So let me see if I understand. So if I had this entire range of observables, I mean, that's sort of I would think of that as a less efficient way of doing it, because a lot of those observables aren't going to mean anything, especially in the first year of running. This mapping takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of work to simulate a model and put it through, right?
Right.
So we want to do as little of that as possible.
But essentially you're telling us I have to look at a large class of models and compare in this space of observables, compare the model output to the data.
That's right.
And that's not the inverse problem, that's really just shooting, right? I mean, you could be looking at the completely wrong models and you would never know. And I also thought that the list of questions was a way of sort of eliminating large portions of models by the asking the smart questions. Okay, this is not what you're trying to do.
No, but if you know different signatures of the different models, you know what.
Well, you don't know because you don't even know.
But you can, if you find out that all super models.
If you say MS is M and little Higgs, okay, I have two models.
No, yeah, sure, you need more.
I mean that's really more than two, right? Because you can go to many different regions of parameter space in those two scenarios.
I mean, even in this chain, that will cost a lot of time, right?
Not a whole lot. If you have a set of data, you have some actual n data here, and that restricts you to a very small class immediately within the context of SUSY model and this little Higgs model.
Can I maybe ask Jim Wells' question a different way? I mean, since the experimentalists are in their first 100 inverse picobarns or 10 or whatever it turns out to be, they're going to do all the analysis that they can do, right? They know their efficiency is better than we do, and they will do every single observable they know how to do. And then anybody, if you want to know what constraints that places on your favorite part of theory space, you run your favorite part of theory space and you see what's left. So that's, you know, what that's certainly just going to happen, right?
Sure.
So what is, I'm not sure, what is this adding to that?
I mean, it's a matter of coming up with, you know, the observables that, you know, will be the most helpful in making that discrimination. I mean, what do you want the experimentalists to do first before they do anything else? I mean, are they going to be able to throw everything at?
They're going to do everything they can.
Jay, are you saying that
allows them to do?
Are you saying that? I mean, are you hoping that the experimentalists will listen to you when you give them a list?
This is the BSM group.
So you're saying, when you're done here, that these guys, you're going to make a priority list of observables. So I guess what the question was is, they're just going to do everything anyway. But you're saying, okay, but maybe you should do these in this order. Is that what you're saying? Or these should be prioritized?
I mean, the thing is, I don't think they really are going to do everything at once. There's going to be a lot of things that they have to do.
You're giving them a wish list, and presumably your
that's right.
Group,
I mean, I wouldn't even call it a wish list. We're trying to design the first year of analysis.
Okay, so the presumption which was going around before in our discussion was that they were just going to do everything, and you're saying that's just not true.
So I mean, read the CMS PTBR, right? What?
You're really aiming for like next winter, right? When they have like a very small amount of data, most of the work is still getting the detector going.
Yeah. LHC 09. That's why I.
But what criteria are these the best in some sense? I mean, you haven't showed us that. Basically, you said this is the analysis path, but I mean, how was it selected?
I mean, it's selected because that's what you can do with missing ET in the first 100 inverse picobarns, where you have a reasonable rejection of standard model backgrounds. I mean, if you want to know what they plan on doing, you should read the TDR, and I mean that's what they're going to plan on doing, and presumably what they're going to plan on doing, unless they just wasted their time writing thousands of pages.
That's right. This path is specific to the low luminosity.
Yes.
It's
yes.
Very helpful path for the low luminosity.
And what we want to know is, how can we break up that path in such a way that we can do something reasonable with that small amount of data,
right?
And then know what to do with LHC 10.
I mean, a very important question here is, what are they going to publish? What are they going to
This is like pre-designing of the first papers that come out of the LHC.
So if they can agree on something, some set of numbers that they're going to give us, it might be useful for us to try to reproduce. That would be helpful.
And I think, in retretrospect, I should kind of almost apologize, since I'm not an expert in each stage of this. You know, I had a part of this project, and that was in getting these bits of code actually working together and validating them and making sure that for example that Susie coming out of Pythia is the same as Susie simulated in MadGraph, which it's not. You actually Pythia treats processes that come externally differently from processes that are generated internally. So, for example, if you take the LM1 point and you pass it through MadGraph, I get, say, as I mentioned before, a 7% efficiency. If you generate it with Pythia, you get a 15% efficiency, or 14, something like this. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's a sizable difference, 5% efficiency after passing through this analysis path. And I mean, it's important to identify these sorts of problems before you actually are sitting with 100 inverse picobarns of data and trying to figure out what's going on.
Okay, so basically you say that this analysis chain is more or less decided by the experiments, and you develop the tools to sort of
that's right.
Take a particular model, run it through the same chain, and then come to these observables, which is what people will look at.
My assumption is that this is smart. This is the right thing to do with the person at 100 universe peak of Barnes, because that's what the experimentalists told us that they're going to do with the first data. Now the question is, what can we do? What can we do with that sample? I should mention another thing too. Something, you know, how you shouldn't always trust your tools. There was something interesting we found with Pythia, just a little bit of detail. And looking at production of squark. So now there's different things that contribute to this process. There's gluinos and there's charginos and neutralinos. But Pythia doesn't have the chargino and neutralino contribution to the cross section in there. So for some specific processes, if you have a heavy gluino, for example, then you get like factors of, you know, five difference in certain subprocess cross sections. And you know, so it's really important for people to be paying attention to these tools, and I think for theorists to, you know, have some input with this, because, you know, experimentalist is going to assume that the tools that they're given are reasonable. And that they work. They're not going to be, you know, experts at, you know, doing these cross sections and everything. So, it's, you know, an important part of the chain to have, you know, a theorist giving input somewhere along the line and noticing things like this that I don't think has been realized yet in the experimental collaborations. There's like one or two people working on the interface between MadGraph and the entire CMS code, and I'm sure they have other responsibilities besides validating this interface.
Jay, wouldn't you agree though that it should be fine to compute the matrix elements in MadGraph and then feed those into Pythia and just use the sharding algorithm?
Yeah, that's more or less what we're doing here.
Yeah, that should be
so. The difference you found was it only the way they're computing cross section, or was it also like the matching scales?
Pythia treats the scales differently, the parton showering scales and things, when I have an external process versus an internal process. The interface is sort of ancient and hasn't been updated. I don't know exactly whether it's using the usual tune of Pythia. I don't understand enough of the details of Pythia, of the workings of Pythia, to know exactly what the problem is. I banged my head against it for a while and realized I'm just not qualified. But
it's used in the showering.
That's right. Yeah. So one thing we found just doing TT-bar, we were getting large discrepancies when we simulated TT-bar with MadGraph versus TT-bar with Pythia. And so we said, okay, maybe there's some matrix element corrections or something like that that we're not taking into account. So we looked at the PT distributions of just TT-bar. Those agreed exactly, more or less. And what it turned out was that Pythia was using, when Pythia generates TT-bar, it uses the full center of mass energy of the collision as the beginning of the parton shower scale. And so what you're getting is you'd have, you know, very, very hard jets coming out of the Pythia sample that would then skew the distributions for it in the end. So if I had it just coming from MadGraph, you know, everything would look a lot softer because I wasn't taking into account these extra hard jets coming from radiation. I mean, that itself shouldn't have too much of an effect on Suzy production, because there's not as much phase space for those hard jets, but there's still a large discrepancy that we haven't been able to figure out yet, this order 5%. So something's different in the parton shower or somewhere, and that needs to be tracked down.
The extra diagrams in MadGraph to see if you compute the...
Yeah, I did that, and it's not the source of this discrepancy. I mean, this is really a small thing, because it's only one or two subprocesses in, you know, squark anti-squark production really will be dominated by just, you know, gluon in the intermediate state. So,
can I come back to a physics question? When you look at this model, I mean, can you tell us how your different models that you simulated? Do you have a lot of discriminating power once you look at these different observables and plots that are shown there?
But with the models that we considered, yes. You can take, for example, a scaled down. So if you have a little Higgs model with a certain spectrum, so say you have, so there's some heavy T-odd quarks here, and then some intermediate charged and neutral gauge bosons, and then a neutral dark matter particle. Now I can have there's a SUSY model that is a look-alike of this little Higgs model that has a somewhat scaled down spectrum. But it is very similar. Squarks are sitting up here.
Look alike in terms of total number of events.
In terms of events that go that get through here. But otherwise these are very much look-alike models. And again, I don't have any plots to show you because they're sitting in my inbox, but we found that there are some discriminating variables between these scenarios. So we have two groups of analyses. One, we had just compare five or six different SUSY models that are not tied to MSUGRA. And then we have group two analysis where everything is done with MadGraph. So at least, whether this 7% or 14%, we don't want to compare apples with oranges. So we have a set of SUSY models that's generated just with Pythia. And then we have a comparison between little Higgs models and a couple SUSY models where everything's done with MadGraph. And we sort of separated these two analyses because of this problem that we haven't tied down yet.
Are you using shape or those information?
No shapes, just binning.
Just now?
Because shapes we probably won't understand very well at this stage.
Yeah,
because everything is also done at leading order, and next leading order can change shapes significantly. Yeah. We have a lot of loss of information, but the question is, what can we do? What can we do with that smaller amount of information?
I thought you were just saying that only information we have is a number of events for these.
That's right.
And has a big estimation power for theories.
I wouldn't call it big. We only could look at a small subclass of models, but again, you're not going to be able to have large discriminating power in 100 inverse picobarns. The question is, what discriminating power will we have at that stage?
I guess I worry a little bit about, when we say look-alike, that means that you think you understand your efficiencies for passing all these cuts for the little things versus some SUSY model, right?
That's right.
Really understand it so well, or could you?
You can imagine that there are, if you take into account next leading order effects, for example, in the production for these things, you're going to imagine there's going to be changes, of course. But you need to have a routine in place in the beginning. And the question is, how much do my discriminating variables change? Do all of a sudden my discriminating variables become non-discriminating if I take into account next to leading order effects? That's not so clear to me that would be the case. And like I said, it's more of a method in progress rather than take the results and believe these for everything they're worth.
So let's say you take the 7%, 15% seriously as your theory systematic uncertainty and how well you can model, right? Which is probably reasonable. Put the same thing in, get different things out. You want to know how, so I guess the right criterion is roughly that you want to have things that are not sensitive to the difference between MadGraph LM1 and Pythia LM1, but are sensitive to the things we care more about.
There's going to be some systematic uncertainties that need to be taken into account. But this is something that can be addressed and fixed before that comes around.
Scale, it's a real physical example, right?
Excuse me.
If it's really the scale that you use for the proton shower, it's a physical ambiguity that you don't know unless you do next to leading order calculations. So.
But the
process, you want really robust observables that are telling you something about the models, as opposed to observables that are telling you about what the right Pythia matching scale is, some correlated way. Pythia shower scale.
Yeah, so we have a list of different systematics that are going to contribute to this, and you need to estimate those as well. I'm not saying that you don't have to worry about that.
Slightly more focused question, which is that early on you wrote down this telling the difference between 1 and 3 in the energy particles and 2. So how do you do that?
Again, I haven't had a chance to look at the results of.
Do you simulate any models with 1 or 3
We haven't simulated them though, but I think.
Okay, so how do you know that you're?
I mean, I think, you know, the claim is that, you know, with this setup, that, you know, you've thrown out. So if you have more missing energy particles, then you're going to have less missing ET, basically, because everything's going to be distributed through the detector, right?
You can always compensate for that by just increasing
splitting,
right?
Sure. I mean. Again, it's not a list of absolutes, but it's I would say compelling evidence for each one of those things. I shouldn't say really discriminate, but
right. Well, compelling evidence is good enough.
Within the the subclass of models that we've been working with for years, then you can probably make this discrimination.
Well, PJ's going to be here all week.
The colloquium is moved by Eva.